The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, October 11th, 2016. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kathy O'Neill, author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Also on the program today, Republican Civil War. I mean, it's not really a war, and it's certainly not civil. But they are caught between a rock and a hard place, ladies and gentlemen. Meanwhile, WikiLeaks releases more Clinton emails, including excerpts of speech transcripts. New polls show Clinton in double-digit lead. And an interesting dynamic happening with Republican married women and Republican married men. They're not talking as much as they used to be. Also, the debate stunt that didn't happen. All that and more on today's program. It's, you know, we're getting into that zone where it's going to be mostly all election all the time. I mean, we're not seeing any particular legislative activity going on right now. The Supreme Court, of course, as you know, is 4-4. There are questions about whether or not different states are doing what they're supposed to in terms of not disenfranchising voters. Ari Berman has a great piece. I interview him for Ring of Fire this week on how difficult Texas has made it to register voters. There are 3 million voters that it's being, I guess, you've got to go through the whole piece to figure to basically suss it out, but Texas has made it virtually impossible for any organization to mount a statewide initiative to register voters. It needs to be done county by county, and there's something like 300 counties or 400 counties in Texas. And the reason why they do it, apparently Berman spoke to the Obama registration drive people, and they said, even based on, you know, if we took what we did in Florida and did it in Texas, we could only register a quarter of the ones that we did in Florida because of the way these things are set up. There is, you
Rick
know,
Scott's like, that's brilliant.
How can we adopt this here? It's a fascinating story, but there's just not much else happening. Big stuff. Frankly, other than the election and, you know, the WikiLeaks email releases. And in the fun half of the program today and over the next couple of days, I mean, people should email me. I mean, I've gone through these things and, you know, a couple of people on Twitter have been, why aren't you talking more about this? I mean, it came out 3 or 4 days ago and we haven't had a live show. And
we're talked carrying a little water bit. For Hillary.
But for the most part, the emails and what has been released, and I know there's some people who are out there questioning their authenticity. I don't think there's any doubt that these are authentic. I think it's possible that people get confused because there are other people putting out fake stuff. For the most part, though, I think it's authentic. And, you know, I can see why some people would get criticized by saying there's no big deal here or there's nothing surprising here, because those are people who have not been, as I have, for probably a decade, maybe more, well, probably more, for as long as I've been on the radio, have basically said that, you know, has outlined an opinion of Hillary Clinton as being someone who friendly with the banks, who is a centrist, and dispositionally who has not much imagination. Not surprised that there were officials at the Center for American Progress who were suggesting that she should not adopt a $15 minimum wage, because she didn't adopt a $15 minimum wage. And Center for American Progress was staffed by a lot of people who left the first Clinton administration. I mean, I don't know. So people should email me or with specifics as to what it is that, you know, we'll go over a couple of them. But the public-private thing to me is I mean, if there's anybody who thinks that we don't have politicians who discuss things in private and then come out with a public position that is, I don't know, 180 degrees from, but is different. I mean, of course. But by all means, send specific emails and tell me what is there. There is a piece in the New Yorker that I want to read. Where is that piece? I thought I had it up. Oh, it was on how Jared Kushner is actually the one who's really running, managing the campaign. And we have a story about what they had tried to do at the debate that I think indicates that. But where will I be reading that piece in the New Yorker? On my texture app. On my texture app. The Texture app lets you tap into the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. You can breeze through hundreds of your favorite magazines, including back issues, pick the articles that interest you the most. It's sort of set up like Netflix, right? Like, there's a bunch of TV shows you want to watch, or Hulu, or one of those type of services. You pay a monthly fee, and you get a wide variety of television, I guess, or film, or whatever they call it now, content, video content. Well, this is basically the same thing for magazines. It's made it easy to find articles you care about. I don't just get to read The New Yorker or Family Handyman. I get specific articles. You can favorite them. You can create basically your own magazine, or you can browse through the magazines. It doesn't matter. You can do it all. Best part, Texture's offering my listeners a free trial right now when you go to texture.com/majority. You gain immediate entry to all the top magazines, including back issues and bonus video content. You can start binge reading for free right now when you go to texture.com/majority. That's texture.com/majority. Women's Wear Daily, I don't read that one, but Variety are now including the Texture app. Variety, it's nice. I like to keep a little bit of track on what's going on in my old business, as it were. Here's a couple of the magazines that you might be interested in. One is Variety. Michael likes to read Adweek and All Recipes. Dwell is one that I check out.
That's a very cool magazine.
Obviously, Consumer Reports. I do. I am sort of obsessive about it.
Zero doubt that you read Consumer Reports.
What else on this list that I have? I didn't see Family Handyman in this, and maybe it's not as popular as I thought it was. New York Magazine, The New Yorker, of course. Popular Mechanics, I read. Check that out. Sound and Vision, Sports Illustrated, you can read. There's tons. Wired, Truck Trend, I don't read that one. Today's Parent, occasionally. When I was younger, I did. Wood Magazine, all of it. So check it out, texture.com/majority. You can always go to majority.fm, support our sponsors to check out more stuff. Let's listen to Donald Trump. Can we do this? Donald Trump in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, reiterating his call. You know, it's interesting. I don't know. I haven't been watching that much news, but this part of the debate, I've spoken to a lot of people, people who are not like big politicos per se during the course of the year, but obviously get more interested in the election. But bar none, this was the part that they just say to me, like, what the frick? This is out of control. That in the course of a debate or just period, that you would have a presidential candidate. A, it's not supposed to work where the president says to the attorney general, go investigate this person. That's not supposed to be the relationship between the attorney general and the president. But also that you would do it to your opponent, and that you would also say it in the context of a political campaign. But it's just this stuff, the bar, you know, I was on Hayes last night and I said, the bar has not been lowered. It's just been thrown out the window. So like people are just, there's a numbness to all this, but here he is again, in Ambridge, Pennsylvania. What's that? Ambridge, Pennsylvania, where he was calling for a special prosecutor again. I don't know if this is before or after he wanted the people to look into the Kennedy and Chappaquiddick, but here it is.
Very, very sad. Special prosecutor, here we come, right? If I win, we're going to appoint a special prosecutor. Because we cannot allow this to happen to our country. We can't. We're like a third world nation. Hillary had no defense for her contract and didn't even try to defend the ridiculous claim that these were 30,000 emails about yoga and wedding planning.
Well, he's yoga. Right about the third world country. And note, I want you to note here, this is on the teleprompter. He's reading this off a teleprompter, and I don't have an issue with the teleprompter, but it just suggests to me, like, this is where the campaign is going now. They're going all in. And we'll talk more about the predicament Paul Ryan's in. But I did mention that I was on Chris Hayes last night, and so after a week, I wasn't on last week, I had to shave. And somebody sent a tweet. Every time I go on Hayes, somebody sends a tweet to Harry's. Says, thank you. Sam Cedar looked good last night. And it's true. Well, I don't know if it's true. I look good, but I did shave. Wow. I did shave. Look, it's so sad. It's so sad. Big razor companies have the annoying habit of putting out new models and raising their already prices. But unlike those guys, Harry's doesn't believe in upcharging, which is why they made their razors even better, and they're keeping the prices exactly the same. Harry's five-blade razors now include the softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, the trimmer blade for the hard-to-reach places, which I already mentioned. I like. I don't want to cut my nostril. Lubricating strip, a textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still just $2 a blade compared to the $4 you'll pay at a store. Harry's is so confident in the quality of their blades, they'll send you a popular free trial set, which comes with a razor, a five-blade cartridge, and shaving gel, free when you sign up for the shave plan. You just pay the shipping. Plus, there's a special offer for the fans of this show, ladies and gentlemen. Enter Majority Report at checkout to get a post-shave balm to your order for free. Go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code Majority Report at checkout to claim your free trial set and post-shave balm. That's harrys.com, code Majority Report. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Kathy O'Neill.
We'll be right back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Kathy O'Neill. She's a mathematician and author of Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Welcome to the program, Kathy.
Glad to be here, Sam.
All right, so let's start. One thing actually I wanted to start with was a part of your bio. I know you were teaching at Barnard and left to go to a hedge fund where you became a quant. Will you tell people what a quant is?
Sure. A quant is a data analyst that, I'm getting an echo. It's somebody who uses predictive analytics and the data of the market to predict the market. So I was predicting the futures market, trying to predict things like oil and S&P futures and things like that using historical data.
And are you still getting that echo?
No, it's good now.
Oh, okay, good. All right, sorry. All right, so let's move on to the book. I just wanted to do that because, I just wasn't sure. We're a little anti-math around here, and I'm being a little facetious, but I just wanted to clarify what that was. All right, so let's start with this. Like the other thing I think that we should get out of the way in terms of understanding the argument you're making in your book. What are models as opposed to, let's say, algorithms?
Well, I don't really distinguish between the two things. Models and algorithms are both things that take in data and some definition of success and then look for patterns in that historical data that match up to the definition of success. And they're usually used to predict future success. So if you're like applying it to, say, a hiring algorithm, a hiring practice, so you want to know who should we hire that will be successful in our company. Then you take a bunch of historical data of here's the people who applied, you know, in the last 25 years. And these are the people, this is our definition of success. Somebody who was in this company, who stayed for 5 years and was promoted twice, say, that could be your definition. And then you're like, well, who are the people that were successful in the past? What were their characteristics? What do they have in common? And then when you apply that algorithm to your current pool of applicants, you're like, the question will be asked by the algorithm, who among these current applicants looks like someone who was successful in the past, has attributes in common with people that were in the past successful. So that's what an algorithm essentially does, is pattern match data to some definition of success.
And what is the, I don't know if it's a myth, but what is the sort of the common understanding of these models? I mean, as we hear them, and they sound like they're in and of themselves, I guess, benign in some way or just effective.
Yeah, there's no agenda by the structure of math, the algorithm itself. The problem is that there's all sorts of ways that bias creeps in. The first obvious way is that the data itself might be biased. So in the example I just gave, where you're looking for people who are successful in your company, you know, your company might have systematically weeded out women for promotions. And if it did, then the people who were successful in the past would never be women. And then the machine learning algorithm, which all an algorithm does is pattern match, would sort of start learning this pattern that your company established that women are never successful. And when it's looking in at the current pool of applicants for future successes, it would sort of systematically filter out the women. So there's that data itself, which can have bias, which will be propagated by an algorithm which automates that process. And then, of course, there's also the definition itself, the definition of success. the one I chose in that example, you know, stays 5 years, gets promoted twice. It could have been anything, right? We could have chosen success to be something completely different. Now, in this case, it's a relatively reasonable definition. But if you're thinking about other examples, so for example, I think sometimes about the algorithm I use, the model I use to cook dinner for my family every night. I define success for a family meal if my children ate vegetables, but my 7-year-old would define success for a family meal if he ate a lot of Nutella because he loved Nutella. So that's an example where sort of almost the actual definition of success sort of inserts my values, inserts my agenda. I project my agenda onto this algorithm when I build it by defining success as I do. And the examples of my book, you know, there's a definition of success in each of them. And the people who are building it are the ones who have the power over defining success. And they will often define success to be to maximize profit, even when it's not necessarily good for society as a whole for these for that definition of success to be the one that we all optimize to.
So in terms of both these examples, the first one is that you get a, in some ways, there's a self-fulfilling prophecy in here, or like things that are problematic that, within the system are baked back into the system, I guess, to maintain, which would continue to, I guess, promote those problems. And the second one is that, is it that there is a lack of awareness of the subjectivity that creates that definition of success, or is that sometimes it is purposely obscured so as to make it not seem like the algorithm or model is making a subjective choice here?
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, so people have this kind of, at least the people that promote the big data hype, they sort of intentionally present big data as, you know, beyond morals. Like we have somehow transcended morals and judgment, and that these algorithms are somehow following the data and living in some kind of universe where there's no such thing as judgment. Of course, that's impossible. There's no such, you know, just by the very definition of success, we've embedded our judgment. So there's this sort of misrepresentation of how biased these things necessarily are. And then there's the fact that they automatically, if you don't make any effort, all they do is automate the past. They codify them, the past. So if you have that combination where people think it's fair, but it's not any more fair than it used to be, then it actually kind of makes it worse because we stop trying to improve as a society. So that's one of the things that I'm worried about and I wanted to draw attention to in writing the book.
All right, let's go through some specific examples because where we see this actually function in our daily society. The first one that I want to talk about was because we end up talking about this in a – it's funny because we talk a lot about the high stakes testing and the value added model to assess the quality of teachers. Tell us what the value added model is just so that we get that out of way. But and the funny thing is when we talk about it, we also never really ask like, how is this, you know, we know it's wrong, but we don't really have a sense of like what, how is this determined in many respects? Tell us what the value added model is. And then tell us about that question about how it's calculated.
Sure. So, the first thing to understand, and you probably, your listeners already understand it, is that we've had a sort of 2-decade-long attack on teachers. And the idea being like, we need to get rid of the bad teachers. The bad teachers are the problem. And if we just got rid of them, then all the problems around the achievement gap would be gone. Now, the achievement gap is the fact that although every sort of segment of children has gotten better and better at tests over time, richer kids have gotten better faster than poorer kids. And we have this sort of achievement gap, which is the distance between scores of poor and rich kids. And it's actually growing over time, although I think it's stabilizing, but it's quite large. The question is, how do we decrease this gap? And the idea is, again, get rid of the bad teachers. The first generation of teacher assessments, and I should say that all these assessments are based only on student scores and nothing else. There's no other way of understanding how teachers are good or bad, which is already damning. But the first generation was very, very obviously unfair because it basically targeted a teacher as a bad teacher if a majority of their students didn't pass some kind of proficiency level on their standardized tests. Now, given that poorer kids don't do as well on tests as richer kids, this basically just singled out teachers of poor kids as bad teachers. It was obviously unfair. So we had a second generation of teacher assessment that was aiming to make it more fair. And that's called the value added model or the growth model. These are the same ideas. And these are, you know, there are different versions of this, but the basic idea is we have now for each student in a given teacher's class, we have an expected score at the end of the year based on all sorts of things, but including importantly the score that they got the previous year, but also involving how many kids are in the class and which school they're in, et cetera. Very complicated. So they have each has an expected score, and then the teacher is held accountable for the difference between their actual score and their expected score. So if they were expected to get a 70 out of 100 and they actually got a 75 out of 100 at the end of the year, then that teacher is sort of given credit for those 5 points. If they got a 65 instead of a 70, then they're punished for those 5 points. And so the teacher's assessment, their value-added score, is essentially kind of like the average of those ups and downs of their students. So if they get a bad score, a teacher gets a bad score, then it means that there's on average their students didn't do as well as expected on the end of the year score. Now it sounds actually like a pretty good idea. It's not a terrible idea at face value. The problem is that it's just statistically not robust. It's just very, very noisy. And what I found, for example, is I found Tim Clifford, who's a 26-year veteran of teaching in New York City middle schools. He got a 6 out of 100 one year on his value-added score, and he got a 96 the next year. And he didn't change the way he taught. So he was led to believe...
That sounds like a pretty big swing, 90 points.
It's a big swing. It's a 90-point swing. And more than a quarter of... And we did this little... There was a study done, very small study. It's very hard to get this data. It's very secret. But I could explain how they got this data. But there were 600 teachers one year who got 2 scores. And Gary Rubenstein, who's a high school math teacher at Stuyvesant High School here in New York City, found that a quarter of them had more than a 40-point swing between those 2 scores.
Wow.
So these are very, very wildly inconsistent scores. Which is it's a really bad sign for the system, right? Because you're supposed to just, the score is supposed to tell you whether you're a good or a bad teacher. And it's being used in high stakes situations for that, you know, with that very kind of concept. I interviewed Sarah Wasaki, who was fired in 2011 in large part because she got a bad growth score, bad value added model score. She was working in Washington, D.C. under Michelle Rhee, the school chancellor, who fired people with bad teacher assessment scores and gave bonuses to teachers with good value-added model scores. And in her case, Sarah has reason to believe that some of the scores, the reason she got a bad score is because some of the teachers of her students actually cheated the previous year. If you can imagine what that would look like. She had a bunch of fifth graders in her class who had really good scores coming out of fourth grade, but who couldn't read or write. And she was very suspicious of this. So in other words, we have these high stakes situations for these bad, mathematically poor and statistically unrobust scoring systems. And altogether it adds up and it means that we have just completely arbitrary and punitive teacher assessment.
So, all right. So we have this. So it all comes down to the expectation, right, in terms of this value added thing. So and in this instance that you've been talking about in terms of D.C., the expectations were inflated because it's possible that the teachers in fourth grade inflated the results of their class so that they could beat the expectations and make themselves look good. But how else are these expectations determined? I mean, what is the algorithm that creates? Tell the story about how you're trying to figure out like exactly what is the algorithm that creates that value added.
Right. No, and you're right that in the case of Sarah Wasaki, there was like artificial inflation of the previous year's student scores, and that messed up her score. But in general, it's just, it's really hard to predict how much, how well someone's going to do in a year, right? What we're talking about is this, we're basically, the value-added model completely relies on this expectation model. There's a separate model, but it's completely reliant on that model being really good. and it's just not really good. It's because it's really hard to make a model that says, oh, you got a 70 this year, you're supposed to get a 73 next year. It's just a bad, it's, in other words, it's a source of uncertainty. That is one source of uncertainty, the expected score for a given child. The other source of uncertainty, which is just as big a source of uncertainty, is the actual score for a given child. Remember that kids will do well or poorly on a test depending on whether, you know, they had breakfast that day, or whether it was after lunch or before lunch, or whether their room was overheated or air conditioned, or whether the test itself was easy or hard that year. So there's all sorts of reasons that we have sources of uncertainty for both the expected score for a kid and the actual score for a kid. And now what we're doing is we're taking the difference between those two numbers. And as you can imagine, uncertainty just gets bigger and bigger. So when we're talking about a given teacher being assessed based on 25 kids, and those 25 kids each have a very, very rough and uncertain number attached to them, then the overall teacher assessment is just not statistically sound. It would be one thing if a teacher taught like 1.5 million kids every year, and that it would be so much data that would overwhelm the noise. But what we have here is 25 kids, 25 data points, and lots of noise. And it's just not good enough statistically.
And is there like, and it sounds like with a pool of or the amount of data that you get from that many kids, that there is no way to really genuinely measure that, at least in terms of pure numbers.
Yeah, I would argue that we don't have like a hidden statistical method that where we could get robust and wonderful scores. We just don't know how to do it yet. And I'm not saying we never will be able to use data to assess teachers, because if I was asked 15 years ago, will we ever have self-driving cars? I would have said no way. So I don't want to go on record saying we will never be able to do this using data. I think that if we ever are capable of doing a teacher assessment using data, it will require a lot more than test scores data. Maybe it would require sensors in the classroom to figure out whether all the kids are participating and what kind of tone of voice was being used and how the conversations went. I don't know how it would work, but one thing I know we would need some kind of ground truth, some kind of comparison of the scores the teachers got with some other kind of trustworthy qualitative score of what makes a good teacher. And we would have to really test this new data-driven process until we were really sure that it was very consistently replicating something we already trust. One of the biggest problems of the teacher value-added model is that it's not compared to any kind of ground truth. There is nothing which we trust, which we know is very close to the answers that we get using the value-added model. And so we have no feedback loop. We have no way of improving the model over time, which is, you know, a hallmark of an actually good model, that it gets improved over time.
Well, give us another example. I mean, there's so many that you go through, including like lending and personality tests, and education and housing and finance. But what do you think is the most egregious example in terms of creating this inequality?
I think for me, the one that kept me up at night was the data-driven algorithms around predictive policing and sentencing.
Right.
And I'll tell you really quickly, the predictive policing basically takes arrest data and looks for and sends police to surveil the neighborhoods where there have been a lot of arrests. And very quickly, the problem with that is that we have in our country, we have very uneven policing, and we have much more scrutiny for poor Black neighborhoods. And we have much more arrests in poor Black neighborhoods than in white neighborhoods with the same kinds of crimes. So whites and Blacks smoke pot at the same rate, but Blacks are much more likely to be arrested for it. So in other words, it's a biased data set. The arrest data is just as much of an echo of the police practices as it is of crime itself. So when we use that biased data set to build a predictive model, like I described before, it's just going to send the police back to where they came from. Broken policing, broken windows policing, like ad nauseum.
I just want to back up. I don't know that people are aware that that is a policing methodology that they used. Will you just explain that part of it? That explain that part of it, because I'm not sure the people know. Because what you're describing is also what you described at the beginning of the interview when you were talking about the hiring practices, right? Like if the company has systematically been denying women promotions, and then they use promotions as a definition of success that they're looking for in their hiring, the poison fruit gets sort of put back into the mill again, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. Well, I guess one way of thinking about it is, imagine that the police were aware of all crimes. This would be crazy and creepy, but just imagine that the police were aware of all crimes, but they just decided not to arrest white people for those crimes nearly as often as black people. That would be that would give us the same kind of data set that we have. And I know when I say that, I'm definitely focusing on nonviolent crimes, crimes that are not reported by people. So I'm not talking about murders and rapes and assaults so much as the nonviolent crime, which is a large part of what happens in these over-policed neighborhoods. We just don't arrest the white people or people in the white neighborhood. Like, let's just talk about zip codes. We don't arrest people in certain neighborhoods nearly as much. When you put that into the model and you say, where should we station police to get the most arrests? Then of course the model can only do what it can do based on the data it's been given. And it says, oh, there's lots of arrests in these high crime neighborhoods, these so-called high crime neighborhoods, which are often the poor black neighborhoods. So it sends the police right back to those neighborhoods where they already are. And it's kind of this kind of pseudoscientific rationalization for sending, just continuing the practice of uneven policing, where it's like just based on the data that we already have. People imagine, let me say it this way, people imagine that because it's data, the arrest data is objective and fair. But of course it's not. It's just manufactured by the way we police.
And so
okay. Go ahead.
I just want to explain to people, like, this is a policing methodology. They look at where the highest crime rate is as defined by arrests that they make. So if they're going and searching everyone in a specific neighborhood, they're going to find a certain amount of contraband, and they're going to arrest people for that contraband. That gets back into the system where they say, like, look, this is where all the contraband is. But that's only because that's where they were searching in the first place. And then it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle of sorts.
Yeah, you said it perfectly. And especially when you add in stop and frisk, where you're specifically looking for, pot. And you just don't have that happening in other neighborhoods. You only have that happening in certain neighborhoods. So it's just the bias gets built in. Okay, so that's something that's really troubling. It's happening in lots of cities, Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Camden. Basically, if you think of an urban center, it's happening. But then downstream from that is something else I really worry about, which is recidivism risk algorithms, recidivism risk scores. Now, recidivism risk is the risk of a prisoner coming back to prison after leaving. 97% of prisoners eventually leave prison. So the question is whether these people are going to end up back in prison. And judges use the risk scores in order to sentence prisoners. And somebody who has high risk of recidivism actually gets sentenced to longer in prison. So the idea is you're likely to be back here, so we're going to keep you here longer. And that's already kind of troubling, because what it means is you're preemptively punishing someone for something they haven't actually done yet. But it is the way that judges are using these risk scores.
I had no idea that judges were looking at some type of statistical model that suggested one person may be back versus another. And how do they determine those numbers?
Well, that's the most troubling part of it, Sam, because it is actually extremely troubling the way they come up with these scores. The first type of data they use is the arrest data, which I just talked about. So it's already quite biased, as we mentioned.
So if you live in a neighborhood, in other words, if you live in a neighborhood that has a high arrest score, chances are, statistically speaking, from their perspective, you're going to be back sooner. So we're going to give you a longer time in prison.
Yeah, that's right. Because you live in that place, Statistically speaking, you will have been stopped and frisked a bunch of times. And if you were ever had like a piece of like contraband on your person, then it will be in the records, and then we will send you to prison longer. But the second kind of data is just as bad as the first. The second kind of data is a questionnaire. All these recidivism risk algorithms have questionnaires, and they ask questions that are proxies for race and class. So one of the questions, believe it or not, in this questionnaire that I looked at for the LSIR, which is the most, one of the most popular recidivism risk algorithms out there, one of the questions was, do you live in a high crime neighborhood? So it's specifically saying like, your risk is going up if you live in the wrong place. And then another question was, did you get suspended in high school? And we know people who get suspended in high school, much more likely to be suspended if you're a black girl or boy than if you're a white girl or boy. So that's another proxy for race. And then the final question, which is really horrifying, that was in this questionnaire, was, did anyone in your family ever go to prison? This is a question which would, in open court, be ruled unconstitutional by a judge. If a lawyer said, Your Honor, please consider sentencing this person to prison for longer because their father was in prison. That's not how we do it in this country. But because the answer is embedded in this so-called scientific risk score, and the judges are given these risk scores and told they're impartial and objective, they are used to, in part, to sentence people to prison.
So are the judges not aware of how these numbers are? This guy's got a 37, gotta send extended.
Yeah.
That's it.
Actually, it's not even that precise. It's high risk, medium risk, or low risk. And they're told they're scientific, and they're scientifically tested. And to some extent, they are. I mean, here's what kind of tricky thing. They are relatively accurate. They are tested for accuracy, and they're relatively accurate. The question, though, becomes, why are they accurate? Are they accurate because these people are going to commit more crimes, or are they accurate because these people live in the wrong neighborhoods and the police are going to stop and frisk them once again? Do you see what I mean?
Yes. And also, I would imagine if you how do you measure that accuracy once you're starting to use it, right? I mean, because if I'm in prison for another year or two on an offense, or 6 months or whatever, I would imagine there's also data out there that show that for every month I'm in prison, my chances of finding employment or my chances of being able to adjust to society go down.
That's absolutely crucial point, Sam. And that's one of the things that kept me up at night, was that this is actually exacerbating a cycle of prison, right? You have people who get out of prison after an extended stay because of their high risk score. They have fewer connections to their community, less wealth, like they have the felony, they can't get a job, they end up in a desperate situation and back in prison. So it, in some sense, creates its own reality.
That's really disturbing. What is shocking to me is, like, I mean, have you ever spoken to like judges about this? Like, are there judges who say, like, yeah, you know, I've always wondered what this number was, or how I got this assessment, or was it just that is part of the problem of this, just that we all just assume, like, oh, this it's math, it's okay, the numbers don't lie.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I'm hoping to do is really get involved in the way that these algorithms are being created and the way they're being used. They're just now starting to be people who have enough data on this stuff to assess and audit these algorithms for fairness. And ProPublica recently did an audit of one of these recidivism risk algorithms called the Compass model, which is being used in Florida. And they did find evidence that they're racist. So it's just the very beginning of research into this field. And it's certainly not the last part. This is extremely important, especially because I don't know if you've been listening to this bipartisan push to end mass incarceration, which I'm not sure is going anywhere politically, but there's this weird alliance between like the Gates people and the Koch brothers and various politicians to end mass incarceration. And the idea there in part is to like pardon people, to get people, parole people early who have who've been in prison for too long on nonviolent crimes. But they're choosing which people should be paroled based in large part on these recidivism risk algorithms. So, I mean, the problem is, like, if they really rely on biased racist recidivism risk algorithms, the people who are actually going to be let out of prison are going to be the people that are on the richer side and that on the whiter side. And it's really quite disturbing.
Give us one more example of another field where you think this is most problematic.
Yeah. So I would say, in the hiring algorithms, I'm not sure, if you've ever talked about this, but all sorts of, algorithms out there nowadays for large companies to sort of sidestep human resources, like when they want to hire people. And what they do, this is very, very widespread, especially for minimum wage workers. 60% of job applicants actually have to go through this. It's something called a personality test. And people who apply online especially will have to go through a personality test, which is usually online, before they can even get an interview. And if they fail this test, they will never get an interview. And they won't even be told. They'll just never get called back. These personality tests, we have reason to believe, are systematically filtering out people with mental health problems, which is illegal under the Americans with Disability Act. So I interviewed someone whose son, Kyle Beam, got red-lighted. That's what it's called when you fail a personality test. He got red-lighted from a personality test when he tried to get a job as a grocery bagger at Kroger's Grocery in Atlanta, Georgia. And he asked his son, you know, what were the questions on this test? And he said, well, they were a lot like the questions I got as mental health assessment when I was being treated for bipolar disorder. And his father was like, that's not right. So his father is actually suing as a class action lawsuit, suing the company who gave him this test on behalf of anyone who'd ever taken the test. But this, as I said, this is like a very widespread problem happening all over the country. We have all sorts of we have a lot of historical problems with, you know, bad hiring practices where we have racist or sexist hiring practices, and now we have hiring practices that remove people with disabilities illegally. We have all these algorithms that are purporting to help companies make decisions very efficiently and to filter out people that would be problematic. But there's very little auditing of those algorithms to make sure that they are in fact legal. And there's reason to believe that they're in a large sense, they're not legal. And they're just propagating the old fashioned prejudice.
So in some ways, these tests become proxies for things like sexism, racism, prejudice against mental health issues. But because they're embedded in a completely non-transparent sort of black box of math, they never get scrutinized in any way, because there's no way to scrutinize them unless you break down where these questions are coming from and what they're supposed to measure.
You said it perfectly. And I would add that, like, by law, the private companies that build these big data algorithms do not have to share that code. There seems to be no way for the average person to understand how they're being evaluated.
I mean, there doesn't even, like, who would, I mean, I guess maybe the Department of Justice, right, would be the only entity that would strike me as even, you know, because this is where you would bring, I mean, if for instance, like, if I went into an interview and someone said, you know, what's your religion? Or what's your marital status? Or, you know, questions that are not legal to bring up in an interview.
Right.
Then I would go to the attorney general. I would go to the agency that deals with these type of civil rights. But I don't have the opportunity to even flag it, because I'm just being asked a question that sort of is a bank shot, like a proxy for those other questions.
Right. So, I mean, so Roland Beam, the lawyer who's suing on behalf of all the people that took that personality test I mentioned, he's actually working with the EEOC, the Equal, can't remember the name.
Right.
Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Sorry. He's working with the EEOC to try to prove that these algorithms are illegal. But the EEOC, they're not Google. You know, they don't have a tech department. And so it's really hard for them to make this case. They're not technically qualified to. And the question is, like, how do we get there? That's the kind of question I am grappling with now, because I'm, as a data scientist, what I actually want to do with my life is help the EEOC and things like this and other regulators when they figure out that it's time to step in.
And I would imagine, like, this is a problem for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, too. Like, how can they determine that when this black box takes certain data about, let's say, what magazines are being read in a certain area, that ultimately that's a proxy for this is a high minority area and we're going to redline it.
I'm actually going to talk to the CFPB next week. They've invited me to talk to them, and I'm very excited about it. And I would argue that they would have some kind of jurisdiction in many examples in my book. Maybe, for example, the lending,
right?
The electronic credit score situation, where we have sort of non-regulated, totally unfair credit scores popping up all over the place and limiting or giving opportunities to people, to some people, and to other people, they don't get those opportunities. It's disparate. Like, I have this kind of fantasy that in 10 years they're going to be, there'll be a new regulator called the Department of Algorithms. But I'm not holding my breath.
But that does seem to be the only solution here, right? Because it's basically stuffing all of these various areas where we make assessments, where we do have laws that protect people from being assessed unfairly, as how society deems it's unfair or inappropriate to assess people. And it's taken all that and basically just putting it into, you know, just like a little stylish little box. And we can't see into it. And there's not people who, I think that's the point of the book, is to sort of make people more aware of, like, hey, you know, there's something in that box that is doing something that you're not aware of.
Yeah, it's absolutely the point of the book. Thank you for saying it.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us about it. Kathy O'Neill, the book is How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy, Weapons of Math Destruction. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link up to your book at majority.fm. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Thank you for having me, Sam. Thanks so much. Have a great time.
Bye-bye. All right, folks.
Disgusting defenses of math today, okay? it's frankly morally repugnant. You can come back, like, we talked about the recidivism rate, the prison crisis, people not getting jobs. You can, yeah, algebra's really fun.
If you like math,
people should do it more.
If you like math, you're pro sexism and racism, basically. Yeah,
that's basically, like, I mean,
saying.
I didn't want to have to put it so bluntly, but I mean, frankly, it's all there.
I was really hoping that we could hold off on the anti-math jihad till after the election, because I feel like there's so many things that are tearing us apart now. But there it is.
It gets earlier and earlier every year.
Yep. Campaigning against math starting.
The war on math.
The war on math has already started. We'll put a link up to Kathy's book. She has a very interesting history. We didn't get into it that much, but like I say, she was teaching at Barnard. Was on tenure track, left that because she didn't like what she saw in academics, became a hedge funder, left that because she didn't like it. She was at Occupy Wall Street, basically talking about the stuff. She also has I think her site is still up. Her blog is mathbabe.org.
Yeah,
I think
that's
it is.
Her site.
So people should check
she
that out.
She is very, very smart, very helpful person for all this stuff.
And it's a little bit scary. When
terrifying.
You realize how many of these things dictate society's opportunities and how it's aged. In fact, I saw another piece that wanted to talk to her about, but we didn't have the time, about how real estate and schools are a proxy also for sort of signifying what kind of neighborhood you're moving into in terms of, like, racial breakdown and economic breakdown. But we will get to that in the coming days and weeks. Like I say, so much of what's going to happen over the next 3 weeks or so is going to be a function of the elections, but not just the presidential election, the cratering of Donald Trump has an is opening up opportunities in terms of, you know, 3 weeks ago we were talking about Ohio is off the table probably. Now, it's very good reason to believe that Ohio is off the table in terms of the Senate, but not in terms of the presidential campaign. But there's but Pennsylvania now, Toomey looks like he's in trouble.
It is a war between the weak-willed fake Republicans who will not fight and those who stand with Donald Trump and persecuting Hillary Clinton, who is the greatest criminal mastermind in the history of the world.
What we saw, like, on Sunday or Monday was what we were joking about. On Monday, we saw what we were joking about Sunday night, which was, yes. And Cliff and I touched on this, was that the performance of Donald Trump in the debate was just good enough to leave, to freeze all those Republicans who were clearly trying to, and let me just put a little asterisk next to good enough so that I can explain this. You had on Friday and Saturday at least a dozen, maybe 18 senators who had basically backed off Trump. Guys like John McCain, I can't support him, or Jason Chaffetz, you know, in the House, like, I can't. And then the debate was completely geared towards the Republican primary base. And he basically just edified that again. And it froze all these Republicans. And there's stories now out how, like, Paul Ryan and everybody was ready on Monday to say we're cutting him loose. And instead, Paul Ryan got onto a phone call with his caucus and said, okay, I'm not defending him anymore. I'm not involved in the campaign. And then had to get back onto the call to say, but I'm not unendorsing him. So we saw the rescindment of rescindments.
I think we all know what we can grab Paul Ryan by, if you know what I'm saying.
And we're not done yet. Like, I'm starting to see pieces now where you're starting to see, like, the Gateway Pundit. Just some, like, right-wing sewer site. Yeah, no, they were bigger back in the, I can't remember what they called them. They were the, like, the basement warriors or whatever it was. Like, the pro-war bloggers back in the day.
We support destroying Iraq from our basements.
Exactly.
We advocate for war crimes in our pajamas.
But they're now saying there's a story, and it's all just like sort of rumor stuff. And it doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever that this would happen. But their story is, okay, so you know, you got quotes like in the Washington Post, it's every person for himself or herself. Now, you know that's from
free market.
You know that's not from an elected Republican official. Herself. Right. To herself. That's the giveaway. That's from someone who is like a never Trumper. Like, oh, we've got to be very careful here. Es alguna persona por
plata or pomo.
They're just trying to. They're not. So this is a Gateway pundit. This is the story they put. Rumblings. Top Paul Ryan advisor leaked the Trump sex talk tape to Washington Post. Now, of course, it's like, why would Paul Ryan, like, what can I do to make this as difficult as possible for me? I know. Let's leak this tape so that I get my conservative. I mean,
Patron, I have not retracted my endorsement. Okay. But you're not going to campaign for me, but you still endorse me. I must be really stupid to not understand what you're trying to say there, Paul. I must be some sort of moron, right? I mean, that's what you're saying.
Robert Costa, who does all the reporting with the Republican Party.
The Post guy, right?
Yeah. He came from the sort of right-wing media and sort of and my guess is usually what happens with these guys is that, like, you know, you got to give him like another like 3 or 4 years and he'll be a diarist at Daily Kos. Like, they just once they start drifting away from the right.
giving him a nice career trajectory.
Well,
there.
No, I mean, from putting aside the career aspect of it, I guess. But I'm just saying, in terms of like politics, like when they start to like get some distance, like, oh my God, these people I've been hanging out with, they're insane, you know. But he tweeted, in calls this morning, many Republicans privately want to defect from Trump, but they say the debate gave them pause since he roused their base.
He won the Republican primary again.
Exactly. Meanwhile, Trump, and he wrote this yesterday, tweeted, Trump circle gloating, privately mocking elected Republicans who are agonizing. One laughed and said, we don't care. And then this is funny from like the New York Times, Jonathan Martin. News, at Speaker Ryan just came back on call to clarify to angry members he is not unendorsing Trump. This is just so fantastic. And I will say this, that I think we're you know, we're days away. Ryan still is putting out stories like still reserving the right to unendorse Trump. And I went, maybe I went a little overboard, but I was just so excited about this tweet that I had in June based upon my neighbor. Did I talk about this already?
Yes.
Okay. But, so I sent that out.
Yeah.
I'm just, you know, there's so few things that where I can really gloat about.
Like Patron, Paul Ryan was seen in Cali.
Exactly.
He was talking with the Ochoa brothers.
So.
See? What's that? Boy Meatloaf.
So he's out there now. I mean, he's on full.
Where's
like,
Tiffany? I want to
scorched earth. Totally scorched earth policy now.
First, my daughter won't kiss me in the mouth.
Now, I will say, in terms of that video, I don't know if we have that video, do we? Where he tried to kiss Tiffany and she did like that big head. But somebody else pointed out, like, he was trying to shake hands and she thought she was going in for a kiss. And then she saw that he was trying to shake somebody. I don't know.
I would never kiss Tiffany. She's a 7 at best. Ivanka, I mean, give me a break. She's a total piece of ass.
All right, so look, the number is 646-257-3920. I want people to call in and talk to me and point out if you're one of those people who, you know, like honestly, my reaction to these speech excerpts were, I mean, I guess some people say that she would release them earlier. I'm not surprised she didn't release them earlier because there were a lot of like defenders of Clinton who were saying the policy set between Bernie Sanders and their disposition is so similar, and I just don't think that's the case. I don't know how different it is, frankly, from Obama, but. Maybe in some areas, but overall, not so much. But call in 646-257-3920. Also, your support is what keeps this show alive by becoming a member today for pennies a day. A couple of dimes and a couple of pennies and a nickel. I think it's probably like 2 dimes, a nickel, and a couple of pennies. Maybe 2 nickels.
You would know.
But
Jill Kane.
You can support this program at jointhemajorityreport.com. Jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code majority to get, what is it, 10% off? I can't even remember.
I think it was 10%.
And if you buy crap from Amazon or jet.com, do so through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on those links. Always buy your crap through there. We get a little kickback. What else can I tell you? Subscribe to our YouTube page. Check out, we have a Facebook feed. It's a little bit different looking than our YouTube feed. But also, sadly, we say goodbye at this point to those people. Goodbye. We'll see you tomorrow and see you in the fun half.